real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome to Connecting Faith. So glad to have you tuned in. I'm Neil Staven, along with Ted Ross, and happy day before Thanksgiving, Ted.
Yeah, big travel day today. A lot of people hitting the air, hitting the rails maybe, or hitting the roads for sure.
Well, and you think, you've got the bad travel challenges. Think about pilgrims trying to get across the North Atlantic and blown off course and landing in wintertime. So we're going to talk about that today and more.
I think a lot of people forget about the details of this, so I look forward to hearing from our very special guest about the details on the adventure of the pilgrims.
Today on Connecting Faith, we're going to talk a little bit about the heritage that we enjoy and celebrate and reflect on each Thanksgiving Day, but we probably don't know as much as we should about it. In fact, I think that's almost a certainty, but thanks to Jay Milbrandt, we can learn a little bit more about the forgotten epic adventure of the Pilgrims. That's the subtitle of his new book called They Came for Freedom. And Jay is with us today on Connecting Faith. Jay is author of The Daring Heart of David Livingstone. He's a professor at Bethel University. He's a former director of the Global Justice Program, served as a senior fellow in global justice with the Newt Barr Institute at Pepperdine University School of Law. He's traveled the world as a lawyer and managing global initiatives in Africa and Southeast Asia, and is with us today to talk about something that had sparked his interest, and it should ours as well. Jay, good to talk with you again. Welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Dr. Sam. Thank you for having me back on the show.
So what we think about the pilgrims and Thanksgiving, we think, well, they're just, as you talk about, folksy people in funny hats. That's not really the story, though, is it?
It isn't. Not at all. We pretty much get everything about the story wrong.
Hmm.
And a lot of that is we've built this commercial idea, and it sort of spirals out of control over time. And, these images and ideas become forefront in our mind, and the real story gets lost. And I took an interest in this because I have a direct lineage to two of the voyagers that came on the Mayflower. And as I started getting into this story, I thought this is different than I'd heard my entire life, and so much so that I felt like there was a need to tell the real unknown story behind this event that we continually celebrate every year.
Well, we're going to dive into more and learn more about the untold story. But one of the things that you address, and it's often raised, you kind of talk about right in the preface of the book, is America exceptional? Let's talk about that. What's the significance of this story, the journey of the pilgrims?
Well, it continues to be part of our identity as Americans, right? I mean, this is one of our symbolic national holidays, and the pilgrims have become part of that symbolism. Now, I talk in this book about how we're really – the story is completely different, but in some ways the pilgrims have kind of come to stand for this greater truth of who America is, that we're resilient, that we're steadfast, that we're hardy people who have continually – picked ourselves up and driven forward and done daring things. And that's a lot of what the story is about. And the pilgrims really were there's a good reason that we continue to recognize them and honor them. And they did some incredible things. And this journey that they took for religious freedom was important. And they set the wheels in motion for the founding of our nation and the Constitution, and there's a lot to recognize them for.
You start out by going back to England, of course, where it starts, and there was I was surprised the extent of the opposition in terms of religious opposition. I mean, I guess, we've just come through, celebrating and reflecting on the Reformation, 500 years, but there were some difficult times for those who weren't part of the state church in England, weren't they? Talk about that opposition and if that was one of the key reasons that they set sail to America.
It absolutely was. And one of the, I think, stories that's gotten lost is this notion of religious freedom, that was the core driving factor for the pilgrims. Now, they faced some very serious persecution. Now, England at the time had a state church that controlled everyone's lives and especially their religious life. The services were in Latin. The services were prescribed by a certain method, and they had to follow a certain format and a plan, and everyone had to attend church. If you didn't, and if you didn't tithe, you would be fined. If you weren't paying these fines, you would be imprisoned, and if you continued, you know, eventually be hanged. And it was a very serious time. And so there was this group of people who got a hold of the Geneva Bible, which the state church was not a fan of, and they started to read the story and read about Jesus and say, this isn't what we see in the Bible, reflected in the Bible. And so we want to separate ourselves out from the Church of England secretly. And so they called themselves separatists, and they started meeting in homes and just in secret. And this became a movement. And eventually the state church got wind of it and started following them, eventually imprisoning most of these members and hanging some of the leaders. And so it really was a circumstance where this group of people felt like, our faith is so important, we need to leave and find a new home somewhere else. And initially they took they set sail for Holland because that was a freer place in Europe.
Could they have stayed in Holland, and would that have been, you know, sufficient? Or what prompted, I guess, going from there across the sea, a much more dangerous journey?
Yeah. Well, they spent about 10 years there, and it's sort of one of the interesting twists to this is that they had a very, you know, a fairly good life in Holland. I mean, they weren't being persecuted by the state as they were in England, but they were starting to sense that Europe was having a very deep religious struggle between the Catholic Church and the Pope, and then these sort of non-conforming states like Holland. And they weren't sure where that was going to go. There certainly weren't armies on the horizon that were ready to take them, and there was no one watching their homes. But they had this fear, and it was not unfounded given what they'd seen happen in the previous decade or two in England and the progression there. But part of what concerned them even more than the religious freedom component was that their children were becoming Dutch. They were starting to secularize. They were starting to go out and become sailors and merchants and doing things that were very very different than what their parents, who were conservative English peasants, had imagined them doing. And they really wanted not only to be able to worship in their own way, but to live in their own way and have a life that resembled that of rural England. And so there were these two motivations of both religious freedom and culture that they wanted to maintain. And that was what drove them to take this daring voyage across the Atlantic.
Well, just to remind us again the kind of the years that this, when the Mayflower set sail and kind of this time, it was what, in the 1600s, right?
Yeah, it was right. It was in the early 1600s. A lot of the persecution started taking place in the late 1590s. And then right around 1620 or so was when these voyages and the movement started to happen. And there was a lot going on in Europe at the time. You mentioned the Reformation, and that had that was taking root, and there were these major changes and religious battles on the horizon between state control and church control. And there was a lot happening, and they were sort of caught in the throes of all of these things and that were tumultuous. And so for the pilgrims, it was, you know, let's just break free of Europe and all the things going on and cast that away and go and start anew somewhere else.
You know, at this point, there were, what, settlements in Jamestown, right? So, of course, we know the story. The Mayflower gets a little off course, right? But, I mean, that was still a pretty significant, dangerous voyage, wasn't it?
It was. And I think we've underplayed this, how daring this voyage was. You know, we sort of have this image of our story starts at Plymouth Rock, right?
Yeah.
And they're stepping on Plymouth Rock, which we don't actually have any record of them mentioning. There is a rock there that we recognize in Plymouth today, but we don't know that the Pilgrims had anything to do with it.
Yeah.
But this was a really dangerous voyage. There were these Jamestown had failed. Jamestown, you know, they were starving. There were attacks on Jamestown. There were a couple other settlements that had started, but they didn't last. And the Pilgrims, the people who recognized the Pilgrims, weren't actually the first separatists to even try to make the voyage. There was another group of separatists just like them that made their own voyage and ended up, you know, half of them perished. And so when they decided to do this, they knew all these colonies had failed, and they knew what they were doing had a high likelihood of failure. And in fact, in the first winter, half of the Pilgrims died of starvation and disease.
We're talking today with Jay Milbrandt. Jay has authored a brand new book called They Came for Freedom, The Forgotten Epic Adventure of the Pilgrims. And it's new from Thomas Nelson. Jay has authored several books, including The Daring Heart of David Livingstone. He's a professor at Bethel University in Minnesota and joining us today on Connecting Faith. And we're going to hear more about the story of the Pilgrims and some of their courage. And we'll get into issues like the Mayflower Compact and how that really laid the bedrock for the Founding Fathers and the Constitution and the American identity. It's all part of the reason that we celebrate here Thanksgiving Day, and we'll get to more in just a moment on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and today we've connected with Jay Milbrandt to talk about his new book just come out called They Came for Freedom, The Forgotten Epic Adventure of the Pilgrims. Jay is a professor at Bethel University. He's a former director of the Global Justice Program at the Pepperdine University School of Law. He's a lawyer and author. And Jay, I want to talk about when you mentioned, I guess, you know, it's in the subtitle about pilgrims, but were pilgrims, separatist, Puritans, were they all the same? I think we sometimes get those mixed up. Maybe help us understand the names a bit.
We do. We do get them mixed up. They're not clear titles. So the separatists, the pilgrims were separatists, and or at least the core of them were. And they were people who wanted to separate themselves out from the Church of England. So they wanted to go and do something completely different, worship in their own way. The Puritans were with a group within the Church of England that wanted to purify it and make it better from within. And so we have these two groups that are sort of active at the same time. And one of the things that's interesting about the Mayflower voyage is that the separatist pilgrims, they are the ones who hired the Mayflower and planned this voyage out. In order to cover all the costs of that voyage, they had to go and find more people. And they found a group of Puritans. And so we suddenly have the Puritans and the separatists on the same boat, and they sort of all get wrapped up into the title of pilgrims.
Okay.
But there's a good reason that we get these things mixed up. And really, the Puritans that came along with them sort of ended up kind of falling behind the separatists. Well, and, you know, there was no Church of England in the New World, and so by default, they sort of all were.
Yeah. Well, before they landed, right? They developed a compact, become known as the Mayflower Compact, and that really was a significant document. Say a bit more about what that accomplished, what that was.
Yeah. This is probably one of their greatest legacy in my mind is the Mayflower Compact. So, the Puritans and the Separatists had, as you might imagine, some religious debate and some leadership debate aboard the Mayflower. I mean, it was a long voyage. They're tired, they're hungry, and they're all sort of upset at each other. And so the one thing we don't give the Pilgrims credit for is that they were really well-read. I mean, we have this idea that it was kind of dowdy, conservative people, but they had read a lot and thought a lot about governing and political science and how they were going to do this new experiment in the new world. And so They gathered everyone together on the deck of the Mayflower when they arrived in North America. They said, before anyone steps off, before anyone touches land, we are going to decide how we want to govern. There is no English crown here. There is no European government to tell us what to do. And so we have to decide collectively how we want to do this. And so they created this form of self-government, and they put it together in the Mayflower Compact. And what was revolutionary about it is no one had ever done this before. You know, this was an age of monarchs and European leaders that were an aristocracy. And so for the people to govern themselves and to decide how they were going to make decisions collectively was a revolutionary idea. And so they drafted this Mayflower Compact, and it was cited as, you know, one of the precursors to the Constitution, that this experiment worked and people can self-govern. And so on the back of what the Pilgrims did in this document, we have the Constitution born, you know, 200 years later or so.
Yeah. You know, this experiment worked, but it almost didn't work, right? I mean, as they landed and got settled, it was harsh weather, starvation, all those things. Talk a little bit about what these separatists, what these Pilgrims encountered when they landed and how they got through.
Well, they had intended to arrive sometime early in the spring, or at least early summer, early enough to plant some crops and try to get a harvest yet that fall to make it through the winter. Because of the delays they had with problems with the ships and then the storms in the Atlantic that took them off course, they ended up there in the latest part of November and really didn't get on ground until early December. So as you can imagine, in northeast United States at this time, it's quite cold. It's snowy. It's freezing. And they didn't have any food. They didn't have any shelter. And so it was about the worst conditions one could imagine. And they were – this is what's a true testament to their steadfast resolve, is that they pushed through. And you know, they were able to build their first shelter and build some protection from the elements. Unfortunately, you know, half of them were unable to survive. And it was a really difficult time and a discouraging time, yet they pushed through and they got through the next spring, were able to start planting, and they came through it.
As you tell the story in the book, They Came for Freedom, The Forgotten Epic Adventure of the Pilgrims, we get introduced to Native Americans right away, and we've heard about Squanto. Tell us a bit more about that. He also introduced us to, I think it's Samoset. I didn't remember that from my history lessons.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot in that story, and Squanto is an interesting character in and of himself. There's evidence that he actually had made several transatlantic voyages. He was captured on two occasions by English explorers and held as a slave. He was taken to England on one of those captivities to help the English government make maps. And they really wanted to know, tell us where the gold mines are, right? and so he made a voyage for that purpose. And then when he came back to North America, he was captured again. And one of these English explorers tried to sell him in a Spanish slave market. And so he's an incredible story in and of himself. And so when the Pilgrims arrived and they were trying to get through this winter, it was actually this Samoset who we know less about that showed up and spoke a little bit of English from some of these interactions with traders and then introduced them to Squanto, who had, English fluency because of these captivities where he was taught English so that they could find out, the English explorers could learn how to make maps. And he was both, part of what history doesn't tell us, that he was both the hero of the story because he befriended them and he showed them how to plant, when to plant it, and was able to help them get to their harvest. But Squanto also tried to use this English language, his ability to speak, as a weapon to kind of overthrow some of the tribal leadership on the East Coast and take some control for himself. It didn't work out so well, but he tried to incite a couple different wars between the Pilgrims and some of these Indian tribes in order to throw off the balance of power. And so that's one of the parts of the story that isn't told a lot. And it is sort of interesting that there's a lot of politics going on behind the scenes and that make this story more interesting and more complicated.
Got a couple minutes left before we take a break, but say a bit more about the, obviously the Indian Native American tribes were there. There was, it seemed with some, were good relationships, but with others, as you say, there was a lot of intrigue there. There was a lot of interaction with the Native Americans, wasn't there?
There was, and, this is one of the things today that is still controversial is, what was the interaction with the Pilgrims, sort of the catalyst for injustice and prejudice? It's like anything, it's complicated, right? And the relationship that the Pilgrims had, I think, was generally fairly strong and that it was generally positive. They tried, they really wanted a diplomatic and friendly interaction with the tribes. And when they came, they were actually very welcomed. This wasn't something that seemed like a threat to the local tribes. They welcomed it because it opened up a line of trading to the outside world, and they wanted things like knives and beads and things that these English traders had and wanted to trade. And so it was an opportunity. But on the same token, these explorers, like the ones who had enslaved Squanto, had done a lot of bad things. And so there were many tribes that were wary, understandably wary, of any foreigner coming to the shores. And so it ends up being very complicated because you've got some friendly relations with friendly tribes and some that are naturally antagonistic. And there's part of the story that we're not proud of what the Pilgrims did. They actually went out and they weren't always peaceful. They actually went out and made some military strikes against some of these tribes because they were worried about being attacked. And so it's a complex situation. And it's all part of this real telling of what happened.
We're getting more of the story from Jay Milbrandt talking about the forgotten epic adventure of the Pilgrims. The book is titled They Came for Freedom. And Jay is an author and a lawyer, and he's a professor at the Bethel University in Minnesota, and he's our guest today on Connecting Faith. And in a moment, we're going to talk about that first Thanksgiving festival. What was that like? And talk more about God's providence in it, through it all, as we continue talking about the Pilgrims here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and Jay Milbrandt is my guest today as we talk about the Pilgrims coming up to Thanksgiving Day. It's a time when we want to understand more about these early settlers, these separatists, these courageous men and women. They were freedom seekers who set out for a new life for themselves and forever changed the course of history. And Jay Milbrandt has written about it extensively in the new book called They Came for Freedom, The Forgotten Epic Adventure, The Pilgrims. Jay, let's talk a little bit about as the separatists, the Pilgrims got settled. They started. It wasn't a fancy accommodations. I mean, they were. I know, as you write about when others started coming, years later, that it was almost maybe depressing to see the kind of sort of shanty town that these separatists were living in. But there was a Thanksgiving, a harvest festival. Talk a little bit about that time.
Yeah, well, the conditions were sparse and. People would arrive and they would break down into tears seeing the situation that they were coming into because the Pilgrims were so hungry and their clothes were tattered and it was difficult. But when we get to the Thanksgiving part of the story, you know, one of the spoilers of my book is that there really was no first Thanksgiving. We want to believe there was, and it's actually a combination of two different events that the pilgrims had that have sort of in our minds coalesced into one over time. And the first event is that they had a harvest festival. After their first summer where they got a harvest, and this was remarkable because now they could survive. They knew they could plant things and harvest them and have a crop. And so they wanted to celebrate that. And that's something that, you know, we've done, people have done for ages, is that you celebrate the first fruits. And they had this festival. And it was a completely secular event in that they were consuming what they had grown. And ironically, they gorged themselves and had to ration, implement a rationing program after this harvest festival. And then 2 years later, a severe drought hit the North Atlantic coast, and it was a midsummer, and it was hot and dry, and the crops had withered to the brink of failure. And when they knew they were about ready to, this was about the end, the pilgrims gathered their whole group together, and they wanted to have a day of Thanksgiving where they thanked God for bringing them there, and prayed for rains and prayed for their survival. And they were going to pray the entire day. And so they started in the morning, and sometime in the afternoon, these clouds started billowing up, and they rolled in, and these warm summer rains came upon them and replenished the fields. And then the rest of the year, the rest of the season was just perfect weather. And they had a good crop then. They survived. They made it. And so this day of Thanksgiving took place that was a purely religious event that didn't involve food. It just involved giving thanks to God for his providence. And so these two events have, in time, coalesced to this idea of food and the dinner table and the harvest and giving thanks for what we have and for these things. And so, you know, we want to believe that there was this first Thanksgiving, and that's sort of what a lot of the imagery in books have, but it didn't really take place like that.
But through it all, as you researched this, I'm sure you found it time and again that God's providence, his hand of protection was on this early settlement. And were there some elements maybe that you saw in researching this that you maybe didn't know before or appreciated more?
Well, I mean, all of it. I mean, I think I was surprised at every turn that it was a different story than I had heard. I think to me, the biggest thing was, this is really a daring story. I mean, it's an adventure story. And I don't think we've given it that kind of credit before. I think it's, you know, it's sort of this, you know, this folksy tale, right? And I mean, what they did was just incredible. And so you absolutely see, you know, I think God's hand through this, and they the pilgrims remark on that constantly of, you know, seeing God in the things that are happening. And even in their worst times, they still saw his goodness and his providence. And so, and then that sort of remarkable story of faith in and of itself is that there were a couple of them documenting this, and how deep their faith was. And that was such a great motivation for this adventure.
Jay, I know that as the colony moved kind of beyond survival, they faced some new kind of challenges. And, you know, the next sort of wave coming and the next generation as it grew and expanded, that created its own problems. Talk a little bit about some of that.
It did. You know, they wanted to create this place for themselves that reflected their English heritage and their rural lifestyle. And part of what was happening was that the situation in England and Europe was digressing in terms of religious freedom. And so more of the Puritans and more separatists started coming, and they would just show up on boats. Now, some of these people didn't always have the same intentions. There was a group that came, and they wanted to start a a colony free from the reaches of the law. You know, it was like the Las Vegas of the Pilgrim time, right? That they had this place that was just a free for all, and you know, just up the coast from these conservative Pilgrims who wanted to create this morally pure environment. And so you started to have all of these pressures they were facing, and as this North Atlantic coast, New England, as it became a place for growth and more colonies, you know, the children of the Pilgrims, they started wanting to go to these places and being a part of these new environments and taking jobs. And so they sort of faced the same situation that they had faced in Holland all over again. And the response from the Pilgrims eventually was to say, let's move our colony further out, further into the wilderness to be farther from these pressures. And the unfortunate part of the story is that Plymouth, that they started, ended up essentially being a failure, that they abandoned Plymouth because they wanted to maintain this cultural identity and be free and separate from these pressures happening in England. And I think that there's some cautionary portion to that tale, because the whole Pilgrim experiment ended up collapsing when they weren't really willing to be part of the greater society. And so there's something to be learned there and at least observed about who they were and about about their interactions with society.
Yes, it's the age-old question, isn't it? In the world but not of it, right? We are still wrestling with that one today, right? How much do we engage and how much do we separate?
Right, right. And I think their response was, we're not even going to be in the world. I think led to, you know, kind of their downfall. And that's, again, one of the parts we don't tell of the story is that we know the 13 colonies, right, that there were 13 original colonies in the United States. Well, Plymouth was started before all of these. So how come there's not a 14th? How come Plymouth isn't its own colony and it's just this little hamlet on the coast today? Well, that's because they abandoned it, and it essentially, you know, collapsed and disintegrated in the years later because they decided to be in their own world, and it wasn't long lasting.
You know, one of the words that sort of kept coming through the book as you read about it, they came for freedom is the title of J. Milbrandt's new book, but just the idea of courage and courageous faith. I mean, certainly, you know, in England, and just leading these men and women to take their families on a dangerous voyage. I mean, the courage, I guess we can learn a lot about the men and women of faith, even, you know, 500 years ago, they expressed it there as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, as I was writing this, I constantly ask, you know, you imagine yourself in their shoes. And I constantly ask myself, you know, would I have made this decision? Would I have taken my family on this voyage? I don't know. You know, you want to, in hindsight, believe you would have. But what they did was really remarkable. And I don't think that they received full credit for their courage and what risk they took for their faith.
Does that, you know, has it maybe changed you? I mean, I know you said you have some personal family connection going back to the Mayflower. So, I mean, it was exciting on that level. But maybe just looking back as a professor, as a lawyer, what are some things that you see differently maybe today?
Yeah. Well, I definitely see Thanksgiving differently. So for me, I think it's always kind of been about, you know, you're thankful for your family and the things you have, right? We've got this house, we've got this life, and we're very thankful that we have these people in it. And I think that's sort of what we've come to create Thanksgiving to sort of be. It's not just about food and football, right? There is some thankfulness to it. But I think the true spirit of Thanksgiving is really about this freedom of conscience and freedom of worship that we get to have this conversation right now that we're having, and you can have this radio broadcast, in part because of them. That in England at the time, that you know, the radio station would be stormed right now by the sheriff, and you know, going to church on Sunday, I think I can gather here, and we can play the music we want, and we can have conversations in a Bible study, in part because of the pilgrims and people like them who took these risks for religious freedom. And so as I'm looking about Thanksgiving, especially coming into it this year after writing the book, is that I'm more deeply moved by this idea of religious freedom and being thankful for that than anything else. And, you know, I think that's important for us to remember today, as we face a lot of pressures on religious freedom. Where's the place of government in that? And, you know, I think it's a good reminder.
Jay Milbrandt has worked in the area of human rights and religious freedom as he served as a senior fellow in global justice with the Anoop Bar Institute of Pepperdine University School of Law for a number of years, former director of the global justice program there. He is now professor at Bethel University in Minnesota and author of several books, including The Daring Heart of David Livingstone. And the one that we've just spent time on today is called They Came for Freedom, The Forgotten Epic Adventure, The Pilgrims. It's published by Thomas Nelson. And Jay, always good to connect with you, and thank you for the research and the encouragement you've given us today, and want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Same to you, and thanks for having me back on the show again.
Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Jay Milbrandt as we look back in the history of our nation. We're going to look to current events coming up in a moment as we talk with Tim Muehlhoff. Every other Wednesday, Tim joins us to talk about faith and culture, and we'll get some good insights just ahead on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and it is a great honor to be able to connect with Tim Muehlhoff again. We do this every other week here on a Wednesday, and Tim serves as professor of communication at Biola University, and he's written a number of books, the latest being Winsome Persuasion, Christian Influence in a Post-Christian World. And we always like to talk about the culture in which we live and how we live out our faith in the midst of that. And today we want to talk with Tim about a news item that's been way too much in the news, it seems. Tim, first of all, welcome. It's good to have you on Connecting Faith again.
Oh, it's great to be back, Neil. Thank you.
And we'll make sure we say Happy Thanksgiving here before we wrap up. But let's talk about what the news cycle has been kind of nonstop about. I guess it maybe started with Harvey Weinstein, and then it's kind of lately been Roy Moore, and then Al Franken, the Minnesota senator, getting in the mix, all with allegations about sexual harassment. It seems like it has been kind of an endless news cycle.
Yeah, and all of them are disturbing. And again, this is what women have had to deal with for a very long time. So in some ways, it's good that the curtain is being peeled back a little bit to show the experiences of women in the workplace, in politics, in Hollywood. So I think there's some good coming out of this, showing that women have had a very difficult time with this. But here's what I want to talk about, Neil. Where did men get the idea that this kind of behavior was acceptable in any form, in any context? I mean, all these allegations are horrific. But the one thing that I think disturbed so many of us was the Al Franken photograph. Yeah. Of this reporter who was on a USO tour with Al Franken, and she's sound asleep, and he has his hands resting over her breasts and looking into the camera, smiling, laughing. And that is that. I mean, all these allegations are just deeply disturbing, but there's something about the total disregard of this woman that he would do this while she's sleeping and then be laughing about it, smiling about it. Where did this idea come from? And I want to throw out one possible idea where this came from. And we have a theory called cultivation theory, which means if you expose yourself to enough things over time, it really does have a great impact upon you. So cultivation theory is the idea that if you expose yourself to violent video games or violent movies, that over time, it really does change how you view violence. And it's not a one-to-one correlation. You don't watch one violent movie and then suddenly you're a violent person. But cultivation theorists would say, but what is the accumulative effect of this? And so let me argue that I think some of this is at the doorstep of Hollywood that pumps out movies that overly sexualizes women, everything from 50 Shades of Grey,
yes,
my bad.
Right.
But even before that was a disturbing movie called Mr. and Mrs. Smith with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, where they're having this violent, I mean, punching each other argument. He's kicking her in the stomach repeatedly, and it winds up that they're making love with each other at the end of this very violent scene. And I think you watch enough of that. I wonder if it doesn't change how we view women as sexualized beings. And then add to it, and again, I don't want to get overly political here, but add to it the Access Hollywood tapes where, you know, then candidate Trump, right, basically says, hey, I'm a powerful man. I get to do whatever I want to a woman. I get to grab her, kiss her. And that is deeply disturbing. So put all of those things together and you expose yourself to these kind of cultural messages, then we're shocked that men actually do treat women in ways that they see on television or on the silver screen. I think it's time for us to take a hard look at Hollywood.
It's interesting that I think I've heard Andy Stanley say it, you know, many times, how, you know, culture baits us kind of across the line continually. And then when we do step across the line, then there's immediate condemnation, which is, I mean, certainly condemnation is appropriate. But you know, there is that that continual baiting, as you just said, right, over the years, it seems like, maybe decades.
Well, and we need to understand what the Apostle Paul said, right? In the book of Galatians, he lays down a general principle for life, and he says, listen, you reap what you sow. So when we're a country, and again, this could go all the way back, Neil, to the 1960s, the sexual revolution. I've made the argument on many occasions that the sexual revolution is the revolution that had the deepest impact in our country, where we basically said, listen, I don't want Puritan ethics. I don't want biblical ethics. I don't want traditional ethics. I want to be totally free to express my sexuality in any way that I deem legitimate to me. I mean, Michel Foucault was a gay cultural critic in the 1960s, and Foucault is famous for saying sex is more important than life. In other words, my sexual expression is the most important thing about who I am as an individual. And so when that revolution continues today, then we're surprised when we see people acting it out. And again, I think we need to go back to the beginning and say, hey, where are we getting these ideas from? And I think there will be a lot of alliances that could be formed between conservatives and liberals. I have been pleased to see the liberal outrage at Al Franken, you know, calling for an ethics committee to be started, and even revisiting former President Clinton, saying, hey, did we handle that situation right? So I think this is a great teachable moment for us as a nation to say, hey, let's set aside politics for a second. And especially when kids are involved, I don't think all of these allegations are equal. I think when kids are involved, man, then, you know, people really do step up and say, okay, this is abhorrent and we need to deal with it. So maybe we have a great teachable moment today and we need to take advantage of it and really try to make some changes in how we think first and then maybe enact tougher laws or tougher policies.
You know, it's always maybe disconcerting to see, I mean, there's the fear, I suppose, of people just using this as an opportunity for political gain, but then to you know, to sort of take sides, say, well, that was, you know, it's just why are these accusations coming out now, this and that. I mean, but it seems like we have to recognize and honor someone's experience, right, and viewpoint. I mean, you and your wife have talked at a lot of marriage conferences. This is a terrible scourge that women, as you say, have dealt with for many years.
Yeah, the proliferation of pornography, Neil, is, I mean, we could do a series of shows on that. Via the internet, via social media, it is more accessible today than at any point in human history. So that has led some cultural critics to say that this is the most sexualized age in the history of humanity, and absolutely that's bleeding into our marriages. Because it's what we call virtual reality. It doesn't exist in real life, yet women somehow feel like, well, that's what I got to be like. And men start to think this is normal sexuality. And I think we got to fight against that with biblical view of sexuality.
How might we get a conversation like that started? As you said, this may be a teachable moment in our nation. What can we bring as God's people into this conversation to seem sort of maybe overly moralistic?
Yeah, that's a great question, Neil. So we need to know what the tripwires are with our more liberal friends. And there's certain tripwires, like censorship is a tripwire. You can't go near that. So we're going to have to make a distinction between erotica, which is what adults find pleasurable. And it may not be our cup of tea, right? But it's not morally wrong. It's just okay. That's not what we would think is even healthy sexuality. But it's not pornography. It's not, you know, sadomasochism like, you know, 50 Shades of Grey. So we're going to have to protect eroticism. And as Christians, we're really uncomfortable with that. We're uncomfortable with sexuality. So if the left views us as, hey, we just want to censor everything sexual, it's a non-starter in this conversation. So I think we need to say, Hey, by the way, read the Song of Solomon. My goodness, the Song of Solomon presents a healthy view of sexuality, sexual identity. And the cool thing about the Song of Solomon, Neil, is the woman is the primary voice. I often make the argument that the Song of Solomon is an amazing feminist text. I mean, in an ancient time where women had no voice whatsoever, and let alone could talk about sexual issues, you get this wild book, The Song of Solomon, where the woman is the predominant voice, and she's openly talking about her sexual desire and how she does desire her husband. So I think we want to say to this cultural conversation, we are not anti-sex, and we're not anti-sexuality. My goodness, the Bible is filled with it. A healthy view of it. So again, I think we need to break some of the stereotypes that people have of us, which is like, hey, we are, you know, we're anti-sex and we want to return to a Puritan view of sexuality. I think we're going to have to break out of that stereotype and say, no way, God is not embarrassed by something he created, which is a healthy sexual identity. So I think we're going to have to overcome some stereotypes to get into the conversation.
Well, I was wondering how we were going to get the word Puritan in our conversation today, but you did it here because Thanksgiving just ahead. Do want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving, Tim. It's always good to talk with you, and thank you for helping us just work through some of these really crucial issues in our culture today.
Yeah, this is an important time in history. But, Neil, thank you so much. Have a great Thanksgiving. Our tradition is we watch the Detroit Lions lose every year on Thanksgiving. So.
Well, of course, playing the Vikings, we're counting on that to happen. So thanks for making it possible. Tim Muehlhoff, Professor of Communication at Biola University, joining us today here on Connecting Faith. Thank you, Tim.
All right. Thanks, Neil.
Well, if you missed part of today's program, our conversation with Tim Muehlhoff these past few minutes, or our earlier conversation with Jay Milbrandt, you can find those interviews posted on the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. And Ted, I want to wish you again a happy Thanksgiving tomorrow.
Yes, to you as well and to all our listeners. Safe travels if you're traveling, by the way, too.
Yeah, and if you're traveling, of course, you can take Faith Radio with you. We've got the Faith Radio Network app. You can download that. And never miss a program at all.
That's free, and just search for Faith Radio Network.
Coming up tomorrow, it's the Family Table. Ted Cunningham will join us to give us some great insight for Thanksgiving Day. Hope that you can join us then here on Faith Radio.